Now more of the starting lineup with James Cebulski, Perry Solkowski, and Rick Dhaliwal.
We are all set and thrilled to welcome our guests. We've got it all ready to go as we say good morning to Brett the Hitman Hart. Thanks for showing. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Brett is a big wrestling guy. I think he's interviewed it a couple times. So there is always a wrestling reference on this show. So it just makes sense, and we've got a lot of people that have
everything
some
comes back to wrestling, Brett. Like honestly, like,
you know? Trump's the president. You know, it's like,
well, isn't that the truth? Did you meet him?
A couple of times.
Yeah, and what was your?
He
thoughts?
Was always nice to meet Trump. You know, he was. I think he was a bit of a wrestling fan, so he was. Like when I met him, he was really friendly.
Because you had a WrestleMania, one of his Trump Casino, I think, once.
Yeah, two years in a row. WrestleMania 4 and 5 were in Atlantic City at the Trump Casino thing or whatever it was. But, yeah, he was always really nice to me. And, you know, I remember, I think it was WrestleMania 4, I took a front turnbuckle in front of him. And you can watch him on TV. He totally freaks out like he...
He jumps.
Yeah, he thought wrestling was real.
He thinks a lot. Yeah, he thinks wrestling is real, and I think he doesn't think the real world is real too.
You mentioned about the idea of telling that wrestling. You also thought as a kid growing up in your household, you know, with Stu and your dad, and obviously the family business. I mean, you're buying into it as a kid. What the business was, and also at a time where, you know, the idea of kayfabe and, hey, you got to protect the business. But we talked a few years ago just off camera for an interview that we had done, and I had asked you, when did you find out the business wasn't, like, the real pageantry? And you had a story about when Archie the Stomper, who Perry just mentioned a few minutes ago, had come to your door.
Yeah, I heard him on TV that day. We had the Stampede Wrestling.
And you're how old at this time?
I was maybe 12.
Okay.
Maybe even less than that. But I remember he said something about he was going to tear my dad's house down brick by brick, and he was going to pile drive my mom on the interstate. And I remember thinking, what the hell is an interstate? I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
You know, so we had a big highway right in front of my house.
Yeah.
I just never thought much of it until about like an hour later he pulled up. I remember he had a yellow Corvette. It was like a really cool-looking car. So I remember when it pulled into the yard, it's like, wow. Yellow Corvette, and all of a sudden he got out of the car, and I was like, I just remember watching him getting all closing the door, all calm, and walking up, and went up knocking on the door, and I remember like I was the only one home, and my mom was upstairs, and I was like, oh my God, he's
home
here,
alone.
He's here, and like meltdown here, and I remember my mom came downstairs. If you knew my mom, she was, she always wore a nightie and like slippers and stuff. Like, I remember her coming down, she gave him a big hug on the front step, and give him a hug and hand him his check and an envelope, and I just remember watching it going, that's. It's really bad. You know,
like, what
I wasn't
is mom
sure
into?
What was going on. He broke my dad's arm. He stomped my dad's arm over and over and over with, and supposedly broke his arm, which was always funny because every time my dad would be cooking and making something in the kitchen or something and someone would knock on the door, I remember my dad would walk over and he'd put the cast back on. then he'd answer the door, and I was like, that's when I started to kind of understand. Like, okay.
Are you really my mom and dad? What's going on here?
And, you know, so those little things were like red flags for me where it's like, you know, I remember also like when I was the first time I refereed, like they needed a referee and I was working for the city back in those days and I got off work and I'd never refereed or done anything with pro wrestling ever, and it was like, we need you a referee, and I was like, so how do I do it? What's going on? Like, I said, it's just like amateur wrestling. You just count. If the guy's shoulders are down for three, you count, and they gave me a couple little like basic outline of a match, and I remember it was only a drive from Calgary to Red Deer. I refereed in Red Deer.
But only? Like a 3 hour or
90 minutes, but in that 90 minutes, they, not even that, maybe about 3 minutes, they sort of opened the whole window about wrestling, like what it is, and how you know, I just remember thinking, that's it? That's all there is to it? It's like, yeah, that's it. That's all there is to it. And then you start refereeing.
You know, it's I grew up in Edmonton, so I, you know, we were talking earlier. So to me, it was during Klondike days in the Stampede where you know, Archie the Stomper would be there or Terry Funk would be there. Was that, you know, and as a kid, you're going, well, okay, this is a world champion. Was that what it was for those summer months, the couple weeks for the Stampede, couple weeks in Edmonton, where you saw those guys come in from the States and be part of it and understand how big the game was? Or
Even more so. I mean, from the time I was 5 years old, I sat right next to the timekeeper. I mean, I watched Pat O'Connor, Luthez, Gene Kaniski. I watched all the great wrestlers from the 60s, like right up close, Buddy Rogers, Pat O'Connor. You know, I was able to watch these really great wrestlers. And then, you know, I think I learned wrestling without ever learning it. Like, you just learn it because you're watching it. Like, every Friday I watch wrestling up close. After I sold programs, I'd be sitting there watching the wrestling. And, you know, like any little kid that's a fan of something, I mean, I would go, that was a good match, or that match wasn't very good, or that guy sucked. Yeah, you know, this guy was really good. Or, you know, you start to have favorites and some guys that made it look more real and more exciting. And you start to kind of get drawn more to the more exciting pros. And then, I don't know, I had a sort of a deep understanding of wrestling. I think the day they told me, filled me in on everything in the van driving to Red Deer. I mean, I think after a few minutes, it was all like, I should know all this stuff anyway. I kind of knew, but nobody ever explained it to me. And once you're on the inside of the wrestling, then you're right, it's all about the kayfabe and trying to keep the realism. I tried always, even
I'm sure you probably went to great lengths to, like, when the business was still, when, you know, even in the mid-80s into the early 90s, before I think Vince kind of went public to kind of save some money on the taxes and I think in the tri-state area back in the 90s. But I'm sure you went to great lengths to protect the business and
all the time,
different moments with fans. And
it was a lot of humor and some of the stuff, that antics that went on.
Give us an example. There's got to be something.
Oh, we'd all pull in a van and a truck stop in Medicine Hat or something on our way to Regina, and we'd all pull in. The good guys would go in first, and then the bad guys would come in second. It was just funny how it was like, oh, the bad guys just happened to show up at the same time, and we're all sitting in the restaurant together, like in different places, and nobody would talk to each other. Like, the good guys and the bad guys wouldn't talk to each other.
Well, I remember as a kid, there was the good guy dressing room and the bad guy dressing room in arenas.
A lot of the hockey arenas, you're separated from each other, so the referee's got to go over and explain back and forth, and he's the messenger and explains, and you dictate a match between two guys. You know, they work out a match with the referee explaining it to both parties, like, to make sure they're all set.
Would you ever set something up in front of fans, like you had to get on the same flight, or just kind of, hey, you watch, you know, just
all the
just
time
to do it, do you?
Yeah. Yeah, Edmonton especially, we used to have the Boxing and Wrestling Commission in Edmonton.
Yeah,
they were the bunch of, you know, they all would sort of make fun of wrestling when you got there, but when the wrestling was on, they'd come back to the dressing room and, like, they'd be, like, exasperated because somebody was hurt or, and it's always like, you know, they'd come in, the commissioners would walk in, the two wrestlers are working out their match together, and then they'd come back all bloody and, you know, like, the commissioners, I think they thought wrestling was all real.
Did, here we are. I think life changes. So, you know, your heyday, I'm younger, I'm watching with all my buddies. Then you become a father and you kind of keep an eye on it. James has always stayed with it. Is wrestling ever going away? I mean, 20, 30 years, will we still have people rolling into right around North America and the world and watching?
I don't want to scare you, but it's going to get worse.
Oh, you think? What makes you think it'll get worse?
I think, you know, Seth Rollins might be the president of the United States or something like that. You know, wrestling.
Wayne Johnson, wrestling, anyway, right?
Yeah. Dwayne could actually win and might actually do a good job. But,
yeah.
You know, wrestling, I don't think it'll ever go away. And you can't take the veil off it. I mean, they've tried that, and that doesn't matter. You know, wrestling is a funny entertainment, or form of entertainment, in the sense that it's a sort of a curious phenomenon that allows people to let out their aggressions while watching a morality play. That's how I always look at it. It's just a morality play of good versus bad, and you play your part. But I think, to be honest, that you know, wrestling has such a strong attraction to younger audiences, like kids, anywhere from 4 years old, I mean, as soon as you start to know anything, you're into wrestling and the little figures and stuff like that. But there's young people that get deeply rooted in wrestling, and there's older people that love it. It's like a soap opera to them.
Well, and therein lies, I think, the great dilemma where, and maybe it's, you look at WWE is kind of geared towards kids, right, in terms of the PG, and they kind of got away from the attitude from 20 years ago when you're selling and you and Stone Cold and The Rock and D-Generation X and all of it. And now there's a lot of people that look at the mainstream sort of like the McDonald's, if you will, is World Wrestling Entertainment from pro wrestling. But then you have a lot of people that, you know, people that are in their 30s or 40s that spend money that are willing to go and say, you know what, I hate the product now. It's too, you know, it's too pedestrian for me, where now they're starting to explore. Now you see all these offshoots. Indie wrestling is now all of a sudden on the big rise. I mean, it was the territories back in the 70s and the 80s. Now it's indie wrestling that you're seeing. All Elite Wrestling starting to grow. People are looking at all in New Japan and, you know, Ring of Honor, all these different outlets. I mean, it looks like the business is growing, but it's almost because of, is it a fatigue because, or is it just because the WWE is so big now? It's so mainstream.
Yeah, it's hard to really put your finger on what drives it sometimes. I like to think with wrestling that you have all ages. Like, it attracts people from all ages and all.
But I'm sure you hear the complaints too from time to time about what's going on today.
It seems to me that everyone misses the 90s, and
I
was the 90s at wrestling, and I don't know that wrestling will ever get better, to be honest.
Why?
You know, it's a square. It's just a square circle, like a square ring. So you got some ropes, you got a timekeeper, you got a referee, maybe you got a manager, a valet. You're limited to what props, like, I don't know. I look at wrestling, I go, what hasn't been done? Like, you've done everything. At the end of my career, when I retired, I remember going, I kind of ran out of ideas at the end of it. But when it was finally over, it was like, I actually don't have any more to contribute. I have no more ideas. I couldn't think of another move to do. And wrestling angles or wrestling outcomes that you can come up with, endings and things like that. I was always really good at, I had an infinite, like, bottomless pit of ideas of what we
finishes.
Could do in a match. Yeah. But at the end, I think I was kind of dried out.
I love your finish with Roddy Piper, the Roddy Piper WrestleMania finish, by the way.
That was Roddy's finish.
I had a great list of ideas. Oh, well, that was his.
I would give Roddy credit.
Okay,
for that
fair
one.
Enough.
I give credit. It's like wrestling matches are like writing a song. Roddy Piper wrote most of that song, so it was a hit song for us, kind of thing.
Which was a similar one that you had with Stone Cold the first time you guys had a...
That was my match.
That was yours,
Steve mostly followed me on that match. And even the Iron Man match, I think those are my matches. Usually, if you're the champion, you're setting the... You're leading the...
And how long does that process take? Brett the Hitman Hart joining us on the Starting Line. When you go, okay, what do we do in this match? Is that done in hours, minutes, days?
It's in months.
Is that long?
You know, you start to have a program with somebody like Steve Austin, for example. We wrestle each other at Survivor Series. We wrestle each other off and on for quite a few months. And we got to WrestleMania. I remember we were kind of like out of ideas. Same thing. I was like, what are we going to do? And I remember like we sat down and we started to talk. We actually went out to the ring, sat on the ring apron, and trying to figure out, like, imagine what we would be doing. And we just kind of talked about it for maybe a half hour. But I remember it was kind of just sort of laying out. I said, I think the best way to do this match is like a school fight. I said, I see this as like two guys that are in school, and you're the sort of the new bully that's in the school, and I'm like the old baby face guy in the school.
Yeah.
Everyone likes me, and I'm on the basketball team. And anyway, we're going to have the big fight after school, and everyone's waiting for this fight. And I said, that's how I see this match, is unfolding like a school fight, like where it's been. It needs to be very a physical and very brutal kind of outcome. And, you know, we put together such a great match. I love that match. I think it's my favorite match of all time. Because of, like, when you watch UFC, as an example, you watch it and you watch somebody getting his face punched in or somebody's arm broken half and stuff like that, and you go, this is what happens in real wrestling. This is what really goes on. But in the match with Steve Austin, we pretend better than the UFC guys could do for real. Like, it's, I think the WrestleMania match I had with Steve Austin, WrestleMania 13, is more fun to watch than any UFC fight.
It changed the business in a lot of ways.
The best thing about that match is that no animals were harmed in the making of this movie. Like, yeah. It's like Steve Austin was never hurt. It was one of the easiest matches I ever had.
He tells a story, and if you ever listen to his podcast, he talks about it was you who had the idea to cut him.
Yeah.
Right? And he wasn't really great about bleeding and was a little unsure about it.
It was taboo at the time. You weren't allowed to, if in fact...
And he bled.
It was just a lucky break. But, yeah, it was... I remember even with Steve, that he was a little reluctant. I remember I said, "Well, if you're opposed to the idea and you don't want, because he could get fired," which I don't. We both kind of knew he was in a pretty powerful position at that time, and I was champion. So, well, actually, I wasn't champion.
But you had enough stroke. Yeah,
I had some stroke. So I remember saying, "Like, they won't fire me, but I don't think they'll fire you. But we could. What this match needs is going to need some blood. You know, that's all there is to it." Clear. If you're willing to go for it,
it's probably one of the most iconic images now, wouldn't you say?
I think
that
so.
Face,
how
the
white
Stone Cold screaming in the sharpshooter, blood coming down.
Without the
face?
Blood, I don't think it's just another match. You know, but you know, he trusted me, and I remember asking him, like,
did you cut him?
Yeah, I cut him.
So that's not him doing it himself. That's
no,
you taking the blame.
I asked him if he'd ever done it before, and he said to me his exact words. He goes, "I've never done it before, but I'll sure as hell try," or something like that. And I said, "It's WrestleMania. There's no practicing.
Yeah,
you can't practice.
Can't come in with a big stitch on the forehead.
I got this. I got your back on this one."
And so I remember I said, "If you change your mind, you tell me, and we won't do it. I'll abort." And I remember there's a point somewhere in the match where I asked him if it was a go, and he was still in, and he said, "I'm in." And then when he was throwing me the ropes or something, he says, "Maybe we better change it." And I was like, "Too late." I had told him in the dressing room, I said, "Once you tell me that it's okay,
you're going to do it." It's
you
on.
Know, the art is to get the blade up and get it in your hand. And
yeah, how was that done? Like, that's a lot to, you know. That's a lot going on. If people, I mean, if you're watching it now, they know. If you said watch at the 5 minute mark, you'll see what I do. Is it there? For the eyes, if they're looking.
Yeah, and the beauty of it, and not that I want to toot my own horn for something like that, but it was a big problem. Like Vince McMahon is totally not loud.
Yeah.
Totally, the kind of thing you're gonna get in a lot of trouble, and Vince is gonna be there was problems with. The blood on TV. Vince is having a problem with the blood on TV in wrestling, period. But this was a pay-per-view.
Yeah.
And so we kind of crossed the line without crossing the line. Mm-hmm. And Vince wasn't in jeopardy because it was a pay-per-view, but if it would have been a regular house show or a Monday Night Raw, that would be a problem.
So did you hear anything from them when you guys came off?
No. I carried the blade. Once you make a blade, I carried it in my mouth, like right above my lip here.
For the whole match?
For how long?
For the whole match, yeah. Right, my interviews and everything.
So in your upper gums?
Really?
Yeah.
You got it
tucked in there, and then you just spit it out and get it in your hand. That's the whole thing, is I got to get it from my mouth to my hand. And it's like, okay, is this a go? It's like, yeah, it's a go. And then
you're handing over a blade covered in saliva that you're going to cut another person with.
Yeah.
That's trust.
That is trust.
Hey, Perry.
Yeah.
I got you.
I think our show's going the right way, James. We're not there yet.
I'm
going
to cut you.
But, I remember he changed his mind as he was going out of the ring. And I had told him, I said, once I get it in my hand, I'm not changing my mind. Like, you're going to be bleeding. And that's, and then he changed his mind at the last second. And just as I threw him, we went on the floor and I threw him into the railing. And so I got to walk over. About 10 feet. And I got to grab him in a rear chin lock, which is what I did. I grabbed him in a rear chin lock so his head's not going to move. And right in front of Vince McMahon and facing the crowd, looking at everybody in the audience and everyone watching me. I did it and about no one even noticed.
And
Steve Austin's like, couldn't believe he's bleeding so much. And the sad thing about that, or not the sad thing, but actually the beauty of it, is like Steve Austin had like a little tiny cut in his head about the size of a dime. And it was like the most perfect little tiny incision in his forehead. And he bled everywhere. And I think that made his
How long did the match go after you had cut him?
Oh.
Because is that part 10, of it?
At least another 10 minutes, I would think.
Yeah, at least 10 to 12 minutes. It was. I recommend it as, to me, as the most physical and... sort of realistic, exciting match in wrestling.
Well, and it's 10 minutes later, just to paint the picture, Per, just to what Brett's saying. You know, there's Stone Cold in the sharpshooter, the Brett's finisher, and like 10 minutes later, he's still bleed, like the blood's still trickling down his face, which just provides this image that if anybody remembers that match from over 20 years ago now, I mean, it's still probably up there. It's up there in one of the greatest WrestleMania matches. I would put it up there with the Savage and Steamboat in terms of memorable, probably that Undertaker and Shawn retirement match going back. I mean, it's up there. I mean, your Iron Man match.
I don't think I think it's the best match. Like, if I had, like, Steve Austin will call me sometimes and he'll be on his treadmill or something and he'll, because I got the match on right now. I'm watching. It's the best match I ever had. You know, we always both loved that match. I think we loved it because we had a really good chemistry together. And what I love about the match with Steve Austin was it was a case of two wrestlers that are trying to make each other. Like, he's helping me, I'm helping him, and we're building each other's characters with the moves that we're doing for each other. It's very
doesn't happen that often. It was a give, probably with superstars, it doesn't happen as much now.
Well, there's little, you know, I don't know if everyone has that same creativity, you know, like in wrestling, for the most part, you know, all they tell you what to do is the last 3 seconds. Mm-hmm. Like, the rest is up to you and the guy you're working with.
Are you okay to hang around for a couple minutes? Because you're here for a really good cause. We just want to let people know what you're here for. And,
sure.
We got a couple people that have some questions for you on the Subway text line at 650-650. More with Brett the Hitman Hart, the best there is, the best there was, and
best there ever will be.
Next year on your home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Wow, some old school Bret Hart just moments ago. The Hitman in studio, Cebulski and Salkowski. Subway text line hopping with a few people with questions. We'll get to that, but just first things first, you're in town for a really good cause. You've been involved with the March of Dimes for a long time. Why is it so important for you to be involved?
Well, I'm the spokesperson for March of Dimes Stroke Recovery. And I've been for quite a few years now.
And you had a stroke.
I suffered a you know, people think I had like sort of a mini stroke, or like a, you know, where I was okay a couple of minutes later, or I was okay in a week or something. It's not true. I had a full on stroke. I lost everything on my left side. If you cut my body in half, my whole left side was completely dead, and I was in a wheelchair for 3 months, and that was probably the scariest time in my life for sure. And my biggest battle that I ever, and I like to think I won that battle, but I won that battle because I had so many people that helped me through that process from the, you know, like Humpty Dumpty falling off the wall kind of thing. I had all these people that put me back together again from physio and speech therapy and people that worked with me on how to walk again and how to, you know, just every little thing. And I got so much of my recovery, I got about, I'd say about 90% back. And I feel... I'm honored to actually be a part of the March of Dimes team and all that, and to promote awareness about strokes. And there's more and more awareness all the time. You see things on commercials and things like that. But, you know, I like to kind of put myself out there because I'm a guy that I'm a survivor of stroke. And I had a certain, you know, method of how I recovered. And I think I try to pass that on. Like, you got to listen to the people that are helping you. And that's the one thing I did, is I put myself in the hands of all these experts, and they got me back to, you know, a really good recovery. And I can remember when I used to walk in the stroke ward in Calgary about 5 months after I had a stroke, and I'd walk in, and everyone else was still in wheelchairs, and especially the elderly were all still had their arms strapped to their bodies and stuff like that, and they had got nothing back kind of thing. And you realize that you're an inspiration to them. I remember that sometimes they cry. It's like, we're so happy that you walked in, you know. And I would walk in and go, "How's everybody doing?" And you know, you have this sort of bond that you know, because I've been there and I know what they're going through, and I know how frustrating it must be when you're not recovering. But the truth is, if you put yourself, you know, God willing, and you get a good recovery like I did, and you have all these people that can help you, you can get a good recovery back.
How did it manifest? How did it detect for you? Because I spent 3 weeks in a stroke unit in the University of Alberta, and I am as lucky as possible. I've just had to, You know, I should have had my left side done. I've only had to have some operations on my eye and go through that. And I walked around the track back home and just said, man, if I could ever run again, it'd be great. My eye had dropped on me. That's how they detected I had blown a carotid artery. How did it happen for you?
Me, I was riding my bicycle in Calgary on the bike path, just on flat, nice, even grass. And I was just coasting along, and I hit a hole in the grass about the size of, you could put a basketball in the hole that I hit. Like, it was such a big hole, and it was covered up with grass, like the grass had grown up. And so you didn't see the hole. I just remember my front tire hit it, and then my back tire hit it, and I kind of wobbled out of the hole. And I tipped over, and I took this pathetic little somersault off my bicycle. But that, I remember, like, almost like laughing as I was, like, kidding myself. Like, I can't believe I'm going to crash, you know. And I rolled off, and as soon as my head, the second my head touched the ground, I suffered a stroke. And I remember lying there on the ground, and just the whole, my eyes were all, everything was kind of spinning. And I remember seeing a million stars. You know, they talk about, you know, seeing stars. I mean, I saw stars that day, and I saw stars when Goldberg kicked me in the head, too. That's why I always thought there was a relation between the two, because the only two times in my career that I ever saw stars. But I remember I couldn't get up. When I think about the seconds after I had a stroke, the things that I did, it's like a miracle. I had lost everything on my left side, but somehow, with one leg and one arm, I managed to stand my bike up and try to get back on my bike, and I thought it was like a pinched nerve or something, and it was going to shake it off, you know. But I remember trying to throw my left leg over the bike, and I remember I fell over, and it was like a crashed again kind of thing. And I remember people offered to help me and stuff, and I was too embarrassed. I was like, I don't.
Well, you're Bret Hart, like, still relatively prime of your career in some ways, and
finally, my ex-wife and my one of my kids came to get me. And I told him, kind of, I was right where the Pump House Theater is in Calgary, if you know where that is. It's right going into downtown on the bike path. And they came and got me and stood me up. I got up and said, just walk me to the car. You know, let's get out of here. And I remember I was one on each shoulder kind of thing under my arms. And we all collapsed. I took one step and we all fell down. And I remember lying there in the grass. They said, we got to call an ambulance. And I couldn't tell because I couldn't see myself, but they could tell, like, my left eye, my pupil was just a big, giant, black bowling ball. Mm. And my whole left side of my face was drooping, and like the commercials that you see sometimes. Yeah. And, of course, I didn't know what it was. I kept thinking, it's a pinched nerve, and, you know, I just want to go home, take a little nap, and I'll be fine in an hour. But we called the ambulance. They came and got me, and, you know, 18 hours later, they told me I'd suffered a stroke, and then they also told me that they have a drug called, I think it's called TPA, that they can give you that goes right through your arteries and clears everything, and you can walk out of there normal. I remember they told me they couldn't give me that. They turned out they could have, but they didn't know at the time, and they elected not to because
err on the side of caution.
It can cause bleeding on the brain and all that. But anyway, so then it's like the next day, it's like, well, this is, you've suffered a stroke. And then it's like, kind of like, so what does that mean? Like, it's like, you know what a stroke is. It's like, well, I sort of know what a stroke is, but when do I walk out of here?
Yeah.
When am I going to be better? And I remember they were like, we can't answer that. You're on your, this is all
it's your own
unknown.
Course.
And here you are giving back now in 2019, and you have been for a number of years, and it's nice to see you recovered. And Bret the Hitman Hart in studio with us here on Sportsnet 650. We got a few people with some questions.
Sure.
Ready to fire? One coming in here at 650. There is a rumor that the Hart Foundation is going into the WWE Hall of Fame this spring. Can that be confirmed?
Not by me. I don't know. I haven't heard from anybody yet. I hear the rumors, and waiting for the call if it ever comes. But I would be very happy if Jim the Anvil Neidhart and myself got inducted into the Hall of Fame, just because I know that it would have been
tough year losing Jim and then Mean Gene most recently as well.
And Dynamite Kid.
And Dynamite, yeah.
And there's a few others. Like, I don't know if you remember Les Thornton, but he was an English wrestler that was one of the best English wrestlers in the 70s.
Is Dynamite Kid is kind of a funky story, just because a guy who was so talented, but man, he was just had a reputation as a miserable prick behind the scenes.
He wasn't so bad. You know, everybody loved Dynamite.
Did they? Like, because you hear a lot of people kind of like.
It's all easy to say now. And yeah. I remember certain things. But at the time, in the old days, you go back to 19.
Perry, you would have remembered the Dynamite.
Oh, I love the Dynamite Kid. Yeah. Sure. I mean, that was all stamped.
Everyone was scared of him. Like, you hear wrestlers talk stuff about Dynamite Kid and Davey, for that matter. Mm-hmm. About,
Davey,
you
know,
they were bullies and they were this and they were that. But they would never say those things to him back then. You know, I hear these. It's like, yeah, it's easy to talk all this stuff today. Like, oh, the Bulldogs, they were this and they were that. And, but the fact is, everyone was scared of them. They were two pretty tough guys, and they did a lot of crazy stuff in the ring. But they were a special. I think Dynamite Kid had a lot more to do with the progression of the wrestling industry today than any wrestler I can think of.
Oh, I mean, yeah, high flying.
And the fact that Dynamite Kid's not in the Hall of Fame makes you go, what kind of Hall of Fame is it?
Yeah. Another text question in the Subway text line. Brett's book's one of the greatest books about the business there is. It certainly is very candid and honest. Wondering if you've ever considered turning it into a movie or an HBO TV series. You know, and you were a guy who was into films, I think, before you got into wrestling. Do you look at something like that now, how Netflix is and all that in the story?
I would love to pursue something like that, and I think about it sometimes. But, you know, if you're written in relation to my book, I mean, my book's 650 pages, and the original manuscript was about 1,300 pages.
Really?
And to try to tell that in a
couple,
maybe
of hours.
An HBO series could work, but you know, that's a tough thing to pull off too. But a movie, I don't think you could tell Bret Hart's story in a 2-hour movie. It's just too much going on, unless you picked a certain time period. Mm-hmm. Or, oh, we're going to do a movie on the screw
job.
Yeah,
you're going to omit too much stuff.
Yeah, and then we could, or how I started or something. But
you see, Hulk, they're doing one on Hulk with Chris Hemsworth. They just announced yesterday that a Netflix movie, kind of the rise and more focused on the rise of the Hulkster.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. You know, there's a lot of people.
Do you like Hulk?
No, not much. I think Hulk Hogan was always a guy that was out for himself. You know, he wasn't a team player. He was all about, he was wrestling, and the rest of us were just there. But
do wrestlers have, you know, we get a lot of alumni hockey players, and it just seems if you get them on the phone or they see each other, there's a certain connection. Do you have a handful of guys you wrestle with in your time where that's connection, or is it more friends or more foes? You know, you don't mince words. You're not a big fan of Hulk Hogan, but are there a lot of guys that you stay in contact with?
I stay in contact with a lot of them. You know,
who do you
wrestling,
talk to?
I talk to Steve Austin. I talk to, unfortunately, a lot of my friends are dead.
Yeah, they've passed, yeah.
You know, Roddy was a guy I talked to all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I've lost so many friends over the last few years, and a lot of them, like Jim. Jim's had earlier detection, like Alzheimer's,
mm-hmm.
And you could tell, like he couldn't remember stuff, and like I remember reminiscing with Jim at signings and stuff we'd go to, and I remember him like talking. I would talk to him while we signed autographs for 2 hours, and I'd just keep laughing about little stories that we did. I remember this, and I remember he looked at me at the end of it after 2 hours. This is just maybe 3-4 years ago, but he looked at me and he goes, "Where do you get this stuff from?" He goes, "I don't remember any of it." And I remember it was like, "How could you forget?" And I would start to tell him some of the stuff that he did, because Jim Neidhart was an hilarious guy to be with on a 24-hour beat. I don't think I could have survived without Jim Neville Neidhart. He was so much fun.
Who was the toughest guy ever?
The toughest guy ever in wrestling was, in my opinion, I shouldn't say ever in wrestling because you never know.
Yeah.
But the tough guys, I think the toughest guy in wrestling, that if you threw me in a pit with a wrestler and said, okay, the winner, fight to the death, and whoever wins would be the Earthquake, would be like the John Tenta, right from Vancouver here, was the toughest guy.
Really?
Wow.
For sure.
You put him over Haku?
Over all of them. Haku.
Bad News?
Bad News, all of them.
Harley Race?
Harley Race. Put all three of them.
John Tenta.
John Tenta was the
from here.
Toughest guy and unbeaten in sumo wrestling.
Yeah.
Went over to Japan as a sumo wrestler and beat all of them. Never was, it was undefeated in sumo wrestling. Undefeated in amateur wrestling. And he was not a big fat guy. Anyone that knows John Tenta knows
he was skinny
built
at
like
one
a
time.
Tree.
Yeah.
He was built like most, his legs were like cement pillars, and if someone sent me in a pit to fight an earthquake, I wouldn't know what to do. I'd just like, just kill me and make it fast.
Earth, I did not, I've never heard that name. Like you hear nobody, Tonga, obviously.
Nobody could touch him.
Really?
They could dream about it, but he was, shit, he was about 6'6".
Thank you for this.
Yeah, this is great.
We could go all day on this, and Perry can attest to them, at least on my side. You're in town for the March of Dimes. Later this morning, the opening doors for accessibility, which is happening in Burnaby today. And then tomorrow night, it's an open event at the Commodore for the Rock of Dimes. I know our friends down the hall at Jack FM are big partners with that. So an opportunity to kind of mingle with the Hitman tomorrow night, too, at the Commodore.
It's a great event, and it's a lot of fun. And I hope anybody out there listening will come and enjoy the music and come give the Hitman a slap on the back.
There you go. Come do this again sometime, please.
I would love to.
Talk some Flames hockey awesome. At some point in time and a whole lot more.
Flames might just go all the way this year.
You're not allowed to say that in this market. You realize where you are, right?
Well, you can't rule Vancouver out yet.
Yes, that's he knows how to play all the angles, right?
Cheap pop. That's a cheap pop, I believe. Yeah. The best there is, the best there was, the best there ever will be. Brett the Hitman Hart here on Starting Lineup on Sportsnet 650.
Sportsnet 650.